All right, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. If you can take your seats, especially my colleagues. All right, I'm Josh Ellis from the Metropolitan Planning Council, program director here, manage our water resources programs. I want to thank you all for coming today to Immeasurable Loss. We're releasing a paper, which should be on everybody's seat, about some proposals to modernize Lake Michigan water use here in Illinois. And I'm happy to have a panel of Dan Inyard, who directs the Lake Michigan programming offices with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, Michael Smythe with Illinois American Water, who is also our sponsor for today. Thank you very much. And Mike Ramsey from the Village of Westmont manages the water utility there. I'm going to walk through our paper, why we're here, what we care about, and then Dan, Michael, and Mike are going to share their perspectives. We'll open it up for some Q&A, and we'll have you out of here by 1:30 to go enjoy a mid-spring day, a real spring day, which is good. I want to thank everyone on our staff, the many water utilities and other water professionals that helped us with our paper. Especially thank the Illinois Department of Natural Resources for making the LMO2 data, which I'll talk more about, available to us. We looked at 1999 to 2010. That forms the bulk of the analysis we did for the paper. So I really appreciate their cooperation there. And I appreciate all of you coming out today. Quick show of hands, just in the room. Some of you are holding sandwiches. You don't have to raise your hands. Just a quick show of hands. Who here is somehow involved in the management of a water utility in northeastern Illinois? Just put your hand up in the air. Good. Half of the room. Good. Quick show of hands. Who here either drank, showered in, or flushed a toilet full of Lake Michigan water sometime today? Okay. Pretty much everybody. Point of which is that this this issue of the permitting conditions that that govern Lake Michigan water use affects all of us, whether we're in the management of a utility or we are simply a resident, customer, consumer here in the region. A little bit of background for those of you who didn't raise your hands about managing water utilities. The Illinois Department of Natural Resources manages Illinois' Lake Michigan diversion. We have a certain amount of water, a specific amount of water that we can divert in a given year, and that water is then allocated out for a variety of purposes, including to roughly 200, 205 permittees for use at the public level. Most of those are municipal public utilities. There are a handful of investor-owned utilities, and Illinois American Water has 7 or 8 specific permits for different systems. There are also a handful of smaller users who are distinct and unique in some way, the Shedd Aquarium, Loyola Medical Center. They are relatively large as single users, but small in comparison to an overall municipality. The ability to use Lake Michigan water to to get that is governed by a permit. And like any permit, whether it's a hunting permit or a driver's license or anything else, that permit comes with certain conditions of use. All right? What does it mean to have this permit, and what do we have to do with the resource that's been made available to us? And those permits for Lake Michigan water currently cover things like annual reporting on water loss and water use. There are some current provisions on plumbing code standards, some current provisions on outdoor water use provisions. And what's happened in the last several months is that the Illinois Department of Natural Resources has released for public comment a series of prudent and pragmatic modernization proposals for those permit conditions. At the same time that the Department of Natural Resources was working on their proposals, the Metropolitan Planning Council was doing this research on the best information available from those LMO2 forms on how we have been reporting water loss and water use. We took a look at municipal plumbing codes. We took a look at municipal water ordinances and a range of other things. And we've come together today because we have these proposals from the department. We have our paper that we've put out. There are certainly other partners in the region who are interested in modernizing those permit conditions. But IDNR has these out there. Many of you have submitted public comments. I have a very long list here, which I'm sure Dan has memorized at this point, of all the public comments that he received. Many of those of you who are in the room today submitted public comments, which is great. I'm looking forward to discussion at the end. And so the time is sort of now to make these changes. But why do we care? Why modernize? At the state level, This may surprise you, but there actually is some money at the state level in the form of the Clean Water Initiative, the State Revolving Loan Fund, which could, in theory, be better prioritized, better allocated to solve some of the water loss and water issues that we're going to talk about today. Right now, those funding sources are not dedicated to those purposes, and I think in order for us to make a case that they should be, or at least a portion of them should be, we need better data at our disposal to prove that we're making the best and most prudent allocation of those financial resources. At the regional level, we certainly have a cluster of communities, a large number of communities that use Lake Michigan water. It's a sustainable resource. And then we've got a whole bunch of other communities who don't currently use Lake Michigan water. They're either on groundwater, Fox River water, even Kankakee River water. And many of those communities may in the future find that they would like to at least have the ability to consider Lake Michigan water. And every gallon of water that gets lost today is a gallon of water that Joliet can't have. It's a gallon of water that a new business looking to operate in our region can't have. It's a gallon of water that just disappeared somewhere between the treatment plant and the tap. At the local level, we want to make sure that the data that we're tracking and reporting to the state for compliance issues, but also hopefully for loan funding or grant funding, we want to make sure that we're tracking useful information that's going to help us manage our local systems, but also make us more competitive for scarce public dollars. So at the state, regional, and local levels, there's a whole variety of reasons why these modernizations make sense, and we need to take them seriously. So here we are. I would also remind you that the state of Illinois is not alone in using Great Lakes water. We do have certain obligations under the Great Lakes Compact. We have obligations to ourselves in state statute about making prudent, responsible changes in policy to track leading science and leading engineering practices in water management. I think the majority of IDNR's proposals do that. We support the majority of those changes, but we're going to talk today about some differences, some nuances, and I know there are folks in the room who have some additional thoughts on that subject, which is why Michael and Mike are here today to share their thoughts as well. So let's talk about what we did for this report. We took a look at the LMO2 forms. The LMO2 form is the annual form submitted by all permittees to the Department of Natural Resources, tracking water use, water loss, and other issues. We, courtesy of the Department of Natural Resources, had all of those forms from all permittees from 1999 to 2010. We studied those. We got headaches, we got cramped eyes, we got all kinds of stuff because we went through lots and lots of Excel tables. We looked at the lawn watering and plumbing ordinances of every community in northeastern Illinois. If you have your ordinances online, we found it. If you don't, we called you. If you didn't send it to us, we don't have it. But we did our best. Looked at national best practices, and we talked to lots and lots of people. We talked to all these organizations here, including several permittees currently using Lake Michigan water. And here's what we found. We found a need to make improvements in these five main areas, and I'll talk about these all in more detail. Now, IDNR's proposed rules changes include a whole lot of things that don't have a whole lot to do with municipal water supply use. There's several provisions in the proposed changes that have more to do with the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District's management of wastewater and stormwater and their effects on water level and water quality in the Chicago Ship and Sanitary Canal and the Calumet system. Our paper doesn't cover those. Our paper focuses on water supply issues, and that's what we're here to talk about. So I'm going to walk through proposals and what we found on changing the accounting system that we use, making some modifications to the LMO2, but then also perhaps going beyond that. Talk a little bit about water rates and metering, plumbing standards, outdoor water use standards. And throughout that, I'll be making suggestions about things that perhaps IDNR staff might want to be doing or might want to do if it had greater capacity and greater funding to be of more service to its permitted community, and I'll conclude with that. At that point, Dan, Michael, and Mike will have a chance to share their thoughts, and then we'll open it up to Q&A. So, solution one. The current LMO2 form requests a whole lot of information about the water used and lost by each permittee, right? The last substantial update nearly two decades ago. As I'll talk about in a second, some of these measures, some of these numbers, particularly maximum unavoidable leakage, we have serious questions about how accurate an estimate that is of water loss. But using the information from the LMO2s, using the best information available, we see these trends, all right? Maximum unavoidable leakage here in the green line, slowly increasing. Unaccounted for flow, and I'll talk about the definitions in a moment, on the decrease, and the sum of those two, which might be a more accurate assessment of total water loss, on the decrease as well. However, this includes the city of Chicago. The city of Chicago uses about 450 million gallons of water a day, almost as much as the rest of the region combined. And so the city of Chicago's data skews the entire regional number, because what happened with the city of Chicago's information reporting pulls the entire region's numbers down. If we omit the city of Chicago, then we have unaccounted for flow, maximum unavoidable leakage, and the sum of those on the rise. Okay? All told, the best information available suggests that in 2010, about 70 million gallons of water a day were leaving a treatment plant and not arriving either at the tap or on a bill. This is a combination of leakage and metering and billing errors. So we have real water disappearing from pipes, soaking into the ground, and then we have losses as a matter of data issues from the meters and the bills. Either way, it's water that we paid to produce. We paid for the electricity, the chemicals, the labor, the operating costs of producing that water, and it never generated any revenue. It either didn't show up at the tap at all or it didn't show up on a bill. When we look at the total cost of that, it's hard to measure. The cost of producing that water is unknown. Each of our water utilities has very distinct pipe networks, conditions of their pumps, labor issues, so on and so forth. So the cost of producing water at each utility is very different, and no information on costs is provided in the LMO2s. The only thing we have is the price, and you all know, drinking your can of Coca-Cola, Coke makes a profit because its costs to produce it are less than the price we pay, right? Costs and prices are different. All we have are the price that we paid, and when we count all that up for a year, that 70 million gallons a day, 2.3 billion gallons a year, in 2010, the market value of that, if it had been sold, was about $98 million. The production cost is much lower, but we don't know how much lower, and we don't know what it is. We do know that a lot of money was used to produce a lot of treated potable water. It never showed up on a bill. This is a drain on our region and something we should be fixing. So, problem one with the current system is that while that information is the best information available, there are a whole bunch of reasons to have some doubts about the validity, particularly of maximum unavoidable leakage. And the Department of Natural Resources has proposed eliminating that number, which was the bulk of what people talked about in their public comment letters to the department. So we'll talk about that more. Eliminating that maximum unavoidable leakage number is a good first step, but I'm not sure it's an ultimate solution. So I'd like to suggest that we take a few years and start working toward a more comprehensive set of performance metrics for water utilities so that individual utilities, the region, and the state have a better idea of what's going on with water resources at all levels. Let's talk a little bit about the accounting. You take your net annual pumpage. This is the water that you actually consumed in your community after you've pumped water out to the next community, right? Maximum unavoidable leakage is a multiplier. You take the age of your pipe and you multiply it by a certain allowable loss per day. If your pipe is 60 years old or older, that's 3,000 gallons per mile per day that is written off, exempted, not considered in the regulatory standard, which is unaccounted for flow. And that adds up to a lot of water. We have a lot of old pipes in this region. We got a lot of pipes that are 120 years old, let alone 60 years old. And one of the problems with maximum unavoidable leakage is that it assumes the same loss rate for a 61-year-old pipe as it does for a 120-year-old pipe, right? It's a little bit less for pipes that are between 40 and 60 years old. It's a little bit less for pipes that are between 20 and 40. But still, there's an amount of water that is just accepted as unavoidable leakage. The remainder, then, when you exempt that maximum unavoidable leakage, is your unaccounted for flow. And that's where a regulatory standard is in place. IDNR asks that you keep that below 8% of your net annual pumpage. One of the challenges with that maximum unavoidable leakage and why we think it probably needs to go is that it's based totally on your pipe miles. And so if something funny happens in your reporting with your pipe miles, then funny things happen with your maximum unavoidable leakage, right? This is a chart of some pretty extreme variations in maximum unavoidable leakage reporting. Since it's just based on your pipe miles, your pipes either get slightly older or, if you're repairing them, slightly younger from year to year. These should be fairly stable trend lines. But what we see when we start pouring through the data is lots of cases of maximum unavoidable leakage, which should be pretty consistent up or down, or even, jumping around a lot, which doesn't make sense. And again, is another reason why we can't really count on that as a standard. And the reason for it is that pipe miles jump around a lot in the reporting. And here are just some examples. Now, I can understand if your annual reporting of pipe miles changes from year to year. You built a new subdivision, you added some pipes. It goes up a little bit. Probably those pipes are going to stay in the ground. Maybe you decommission some pipes, they're going to come out. That's going to go down. But jumps up and down from year to year in large numbers of pipe miles really shouldn't be happening, and yet it is. These are a few examples. Some of them are clearly just simple mistakes. I spent a lot of time looking at this. One municipality just reported double the number of pipes 1 year, right? And that just happens. But when that happened, the remainder, the unaccounted for flow, which is what's left over, totally disappeared, right? So they went from having 8% unaccounted for flow to zero simply because someone, summer intern, I don't know who, just doubled the number of pipe miles. Okay, and then the next year it went back to the right number, so on and so forth. What happens, though, is because of this formula, that maximum unavoidable leakage, let's just take the 3,000 gallons per mile per day for 60-year-old pipes. In a lot of older communities, the one I live in, city of Chicago, that might be too low. A 120-year-old pipe might be leaking more than that. In a newer community, it might be too high, right? It's probably not the sort of Goldilocks version of just right, right? And what happens is that in a lot of communities, a lot of permittees, on an annual basis, they're reporting zero unaccounted for flow because all of their water loss has been captured in that maximum unavoidable leakage exemption. And then this gets reported, that there's zero unaccounted for flow. What also happens a large number of times is that the maximum unavoidable leakage exemption is actually so much higher than what's disappearing from their billing records that they're reporting water creation. They add their unavoidable leakage to their billed water, and it comes out more than their net annual pumpage. And this isn't one or two communities a year. It's here in these green bars. It's about 35 communities a year who are claiming that they've created water. And I know you guys are good at your jobs. I know you are. You're not creating water out of thin air. If you are, we will have another roundtable about how to do that. So we've got information coming in. State trying to make decisions, the region trying to make decisions, and there are a whole variety of reasons why some of that information may not be that dependable. So IDNR has suggested eliminating maximum unavoidable leakage. Forget this 3,000 gallons per mile per day thing for 60-year-old pipes. We're just going to get rid of it. And the proposal is to eliminate that and continue with the 8% standard for unaccounted for flow. So now that's the standard you should be shooting for, and here's what happens. If we eliminate that and do nothing else, we have all of these communities in blue who are currently reporting, or have been between 1999 and 2010, reporting themselves as being over 8%. We eliminate the unaccounted for, the maximum unavoidable leakage, we add it to the unaccounted for flow, and suddenly it goes from being about 25 or 30 communities a year to 120, 130, 140 communities being out of compliance. And there's a lot of worry about being out of compliance and what out of compliance is going to mean. And that if I'm out of compliance tomorrow, it means on Wednesday I have to drop $50 million into the ground to fix a bunch of pipes so that on Thursday I'll be in compliance. That seems to be the concern that I read in the 102 pages of public comment last night, which was scintillating. Thank you all very much. But that is the concern, that this is going to be an overnight thing. Now, that wasn't IDNR's proposal. IDNR's proposal is that we would drop this and there would be a period of time, a couple of years, to develop a plan to get into compliance. Now, getting into compliance is going to mean repairing some pipes. It is going to mean solving some leakage. It is going to mean fixing some meters and some billing so that we have less unaccounted for flow. I'm not sure that's a bad thing. In fact, I'm pretty sure that's a good thing, but we need some time. We need some time to figure out how to do it, and then we need some time to make some changes. And I think a lot of people are worried about being fined or being punished or something by the department. And I would like to suggest, and in fact MPC did suggest in the paper that you will all spend tonight reading, and it is scintillating, that we have a grace period, an official grace period, where there's no threat of punishment, right? Where we take some time to figure this out. Secondly, eliminating that maximum unavoidable leakage exemption, again, doesn't necessarily solve all of our problems. We need to think about some different performance metrics, and we need to think about a new idea for what unaccounted for flow is, right? Fortunately, we have some models out there. And several of you in your comment letter cited the American Water Works Association's M36 auditing tool as another way of developing a more nuanced and comprehensive understanding of how a utility is doing its job. We have a lot of ways in which we have revenue water that we sell and non-revenue water, right? If you're using water for street cleaning from the municipality, by the municipality, it's probably non-revenue water. It's not a bad thing. It's a productive use of water to keep leaves out of the sewage pipes, right? But that's non-revenue water. We might want some guidance on how much of that water should be getting used. That's not loss, however, right? We do have loss from billing. We do have loss from pipes. And we need to figure this all out together. The American Water Works Association does have some good ideas. Several of you have some good ideas, too. I'm going to read from two of your comment letters about the need to develop these performance metrics. Here's one, and I'll let you guess who they are when I'm done. We believe it is necessary to consider a more flexible approach that accounts for long-term needs, recognizes the unique physical and historical characteristics of each permittee, and balances the economic costs of infrastructure upgrades and their accompanying water rate increase, since these costs are primarily locally funded, with the benefits of reduced leakage and unaccounted for flow. We welcome reconsideration of methodologies related to unaccounted for flow and unavoidable leakage as part of a broader reconsideration of how the Lake Michigan Allocation Program accounting practices and requirements work. There's one. Two. We would suggest, rather than eliminating the maximum unavoidable leakage allowance, that the annual use audit include a new measure, possibly the Infrastructure Leakage Index that is used by the American Water Works Association. The ILI, Infrastructure Leakage Index, allows for a utility-specific approach which portrays that particular utility's real background losses rather than a one-size-fits-all approach as currently used. Those are from the City of Chicago and the Village of Mount Prospect, proving that the city and the suburbs can get along, right? Very comparable findings about how to rethink these performance standards that we're shooting for. But that's going to take some time, and I'd like to suggest that we take a few years to work on this together. IDNR, its permittees, solving this together to develop some performance metrics that work. We can drop maximum unavoidable leakage. That's fine as a short-term measure, but we need to work for the longer term on managing this water better. Quickly go through some other issues here. IDNR has made a recommendation that municipalities move toward full cost pricing, and we certainly agree. Full cost pricing. What does full cost pricing mean? First, it means full cost accounting. It means having some consistent standards throughout the region for how our utility permittees, whether they're investor-owned or municipal, establish the costs of service in their municipality. Right? We need some guidance from that, and that's something the Department of Natural Resources can do. And there are models that already exist. CMAP and the Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant have worked on this a lot. Once you understand the full cost of service within your community, there are literally infinite number of ways you can create a water rate system to capture those costs. And right now, unfortunately, we have a lot of water rate systems that don't recoup the full cost of providing water services. Remember, when we're providing water services, the water is actually probably the least important part. We're paying for pumps, we're paying for pipes, we're paying for electricity, chemicals, labor, other operating expenses. When it comes to metering, there's a recommendation from IDNR that we move towards sub-metering of multifamily buildings. And this is where MPC and IDNR differ a little bit. Sub-metering of multifamily buildings is a good goal. I'd like to make sure that before we move to that, we have 100% metering of all individual buildings first, before we move to sub-metering in multifamily housing. And we have reason to believe that there may be more buildings out there without meters than we think. The LMO2 data that is submitted every year includes a column to ask whether you are 100% metered. And permittees report some information there. Several years ago, the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning did a survey of utilities throughout the region asking, are you 100% metered? And the answers that came back from those two self-reported systems are very different from each other. And I have reason to believe that we might want to do some work figuring out just how comprehensive we think our comprehensive metering is today and move towards that first. Plumbing. IDNR has suggested some improvements and modifications to the plumbing code, to plumbing standards used at the municipal level. And this is a good thing to do, right? We have in Illinois a state plumbing code created by the Department of Public Health, which is in itself in the process of being revised, right? That state plumbing code and the green plumbing code supplement that are being created will set a new baseline standard for water efficiency and water reuse in the state. I'm of the opinion that the Department of Public Health should not be in the business of writing a plumbing code for the state. We have national plumbing code standards organizations that do that. However, the process is happening, and we're very supportive of it. That new standard, that green plumbing code supplement, is really what we think the rest of northeastern Illinois should be using once it's established. It'll save us water, it'll save us money, and there's a whole section on non-potable water reuse that's going to open up a marketplace for an alternative. So we don't have to spray perfectly good Lake Michigan water on the ground to water our lawns or flush it down the toilet. We'll have alternatives. There's a lot of inconsistency in the region on plumbing code issues. Again, we looked at all the ordinances. We looked at everybody, right? And there's a lot of inconsistency. We would like to see some standardization. We think it'd be good for the marketplace. We think it'd be good for communities to get out of the business of having to develop their own or find their own plumbing code. Take the state standard, modify it if you need to, but we need to get away from this hodgepodge of different standards in different communities and move towards a more unified system. Water reuse is another opportunity, and right now, while the Department of Public Health is creating these plumbing code standards for using this non-potable water once it gets to your house, there really is no overall state policy on what non-potable water resources can be as a water resource. We think this is an area where the Department of Natural Resources can take some leadership, convene the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Public Health, other state entities, and start to develop a comprehensive non-potable water reuses policy for the state. Outdoor water use standards. Water systems, by and large, are designed much like parking lots for department stores, right? Your Target, your Walmart has a parking lot that's built for the day after Thanksgiving. And when it's busiest, that parking lot is full. And the rest of the year, that parking lot is half empty. And water systems are designed for peak usage in summer, when we have surges because of lawn watering, right? Now, people are starting already to realize that spraying potable water on their lawns may not really be that necessary, and there are other alternatives. That's good. However, we have great inconsistency in the region on what our lawn watering standards are. And Department of Natural Resources has suggested some strengthening of its proposed base ordinance for lawn watering. We'd like to see them go further, and we've actually been working very closely with a cluster of groundwater and Fox River communities called the Northwest Water Planning Alliance. There's about 80 municipalities. Aurora is the biggest. And they've actually self-adopted a tougher ordinance than IDNR is proposing or is currently on the books. And we've suggested that, or the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning's model conservation ordinance, as a model that IDNR might want to recommend or even require of communities to use. Throughout this region, we've basically got the same soil, we've basically got the same climate, we've basically got the same grass, and it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense why we have such variation in our outdoor watering use standards. If we can shave off some of those summertime peaks, we will shave off infrastructure, increase capacity increases, and the costs associated with them. If we can develop unified standards, we can take the burden off of each individual municipality in developing its own communications programs, its own bill inserts, its own stuff. We can have one set of information that goes out about here's how you water a lawn in northeastern Illinois with Lake Michigan water. And that's a service we think the Department of Natural Resources can do. This is the city of Aurora, and their water outdoor watering ordinance closely matches the one that was adopted by the Northwest Water Planning Alliance. That black line signifies when they adopted it, right? They are reducing per capita consumption in the city, and they've adjusted their water rates to account for it. That watering ordinance is working, and it is reducing their peak demands. And when they reduce their peak demands, they can offset the need for capital expansion, delay it, push it down the road, and save themselves some money. All right. I've suggested several things that we'd like IDNR to be doing. More regular communication with permittees, setting some standards on how to do full cost accounting, providing some guidance on water rates, providing some guidance on ordinances, be it plumbing or lawn watering. One of the challenges is that the IDNR office for Lake Michigan, despite its 205 permittees and the billions of gallons that we pump out of the lake every day, there's about three people in that office. And they manage this program. They do everything having to do with invasive species in the lakes. They do everything having to do with the Great Lakes Compact. They do have everything to do with Lake Michigan. And this program is just one aspect of what they do. There simply is not enough manpower. There simply is not enough capacity for the kinds of things that I think, and based on all the comments that I read, I think you think the services they might be providing. So how do we get there? We certainly can go to the State House and we can ask for some general revenue funds to embolden the IDNR office. We can do that. And then we can walk out having been laughed at, yelled at, shouted at by legislators in Springfield. But we can do it, and we will if we have to. I'd like to suggest that the fact that we submit these annual reports creates a relatively easy mechanism for submitting a small annual fee for expanded services from the Department of Natural Resources to help permittees. In the report, at the tail end, you'll see some more detail on this fee. The numbers we worked out, the single largest municipality, the city of Chicago, would pay about $4,000 a year, which no one's going to notice, right? If you go through all the permittees, this base proposal here, $441,000. Enough for a few additional staff people, enough to start providing these services, targeting technical assistance to municipalities who are struggling, and providing the kind of base ordinance language, the kind of standards on accounting, the kind of standards on rate setting that would be helpful to municipalities. And then they might be able to have more regular dialogue about policy changes, more regular dialogue about how to develop performance metrics together, more regular dialogue about how to work together to manage this Lake Michigan water more efficiently. Right now, they can't do everything that we're suggesting they do, and we know it. We have to give them the people, the manpower, and the dollars to do this. So this water resource is important for the region. That's all I'm going to say. I'm going to invite Dan Inyard from the Department of Natural Resources to come up, talk a little bit about the proposals, what he heard in the public comment period, and then we'll hear from Michael Smythe and Mike Ramsey on their perspectives on these changes, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. Thank you very much.
All right, well, I guess I'll get started while he's pulling up the slides. Again, thank you, Josh, for the invite, and you gave a pretty thorough overview of what we've proposed, so there's a lot of things I do not have to cover today. But I would like to give just a little bit of background, because I think that's always helpful. I recognize some folks in the audience, some folks that have been around for a few years, but a lot of you are new. Basically, the department has been in the water allocation business since 1977. And the reason we got in the allocation business in the first place was because of a 1967 United States Supreme Court decree that added domestic pumpage to Illinois' allowable diversion. So that was really the event that precipitated the need for Illinois to get in the water allocation business. So the first allocation in response to that 67 decree wasn't really made until 1977. So they took a long time originally to get going. The decree was amended in 1980. The Level of Lake Michigan Act that implemented the allocation program was really established around 1969. So this is not all that old that we've been allocating Lake Michigan water. And I always like to just start out this. There are a lot of numbers here, so don't worry about those. But I put the years in blue were the years that Illinois' diversion was consistently above the court limit, 3,200 CFS. The number off to the right was our kind of our running total, our debt. And red means we're in debt. And if you can see, we built up a real sizable water debt back in the 1980s. Back then, water levels were very high. We had a number of problems that we needed to address, which we began to. And as you look down now more towards the current decade, we have paid off our water debt. So in spite of a lot of things that are still going on with water loss that we are concerned about, we have made great progress in returning to full compliance with the decree. And overall, the number one purpose of our water allocation program is to stay in compliance with the decree. That is the biggest job that we've been given by the General Assembly. Second job is really an expansion of that, is really to develop an equitable program to allocate a legally scarce resource in a fashion that is fair and equitable to all potential users throughout northeastern Illinois. That not only includes domestic use, but also use to operate the Chicago waterway system. Today, I'll just really talk about the domestic side of things. Another piece of good news is that over time, our use of Lake Michigan water has been decreasing. This has happened while we've still been able to expand the service area. And if you look, you'll see we've actually gone down about 250 million gallons a day, average daily use. A very, very significant reduction in water use than what we were faced with early on. And if you look, this is just the same thing except without Chicago. Obviously, the reduction in the city of Chicago has been driving the reduction regionally in water use. But even without Chicago, you'll still see we've seen a reduction since 2005. And the early years really represent the expansion of Lake Michigan water to DuPage County and to Northwest Cook. So we significantly expanded the water service area. It's been relatively static over the last 4 or 5 years, and you see decreases. I actually happen to think a lot of that decrease is due to increases in water rates. I think there's been a fairly significant change in water use habits in the region. One point I want to make, too, and Josh went over maximum unavoidable leakage and unaccounted for flow in great detail, so I don't need to. But one point that he didn't emphasize that I would like to is this. Maximum unavoidable leakage is really the way it sounds. That formula that was developed with the miles of main and the age of pipe, the type of pipe, was really designed to be an equalization factor back in the late 1970s and 80s so that when we had an 8% unaccounted for flow standard, we weren't penalizing older communities with older pipe compared to newer suburban areas. And so that was designed to try to level the playing field so that the recognition would be that with that allowance, and by the way, it's voluntary. We don't make anybody take the maximum unavoidable leakage. They all do, but they don't have to. There's no rule that says they have to write off that as water loss. But again, the intent was then with that, and it's actually in our rules, we assume unaccounted for flow should be close to zero because of that MUL allowance. Well, what has happened over time is the 8%, it seems to have evolved into a design standard, which it was never intended to be. It was really just the level at which, if it exceeded that, then we as a state would say, hey, wait a minute, you really should take a look at your system and your water loss and figure out what you need to do to reduce your water loss. So it was never intended to be a design standard, but that appears to be the way it has actually evolved over time. And this is just a regional average on account for flow. Josh had some similar data up there. And we initially made some fairly good progress, but since 2000, it's really sort of leveled off. We consistently see about the same number of communities every year that exceed that unaccounted for flow standard. And then when you take a look at the maximum unavoidable leakage, One of the things that started to concern us as an agency and realize that, hey, you know, maybe the time for unavoidable leakage is passing us by, is the apparent increase in a regional average unavoidable leakage. It used to be, you know, 5%, 4.5%. Lately, it seems like it's climbing over 7%. I'm not exactly sure why that's happened. Obviously, some pipe is aged, but we've had a lot of new pipe put in the ground as well. So that was one of the things we began to realize, that as the cost of water has escalated in this region, and, you know, we used to do water rate surveys in a five-year period, you know, today that would be far too long of a period to capture water rate changes because things are happening very quickly. But we certainly began to realize that we probably weren't doing our communities any favors by maintaining the system that we've set up in 1980 to monitor what we would consider good system performance today. The price of water has gone up. The technology has evolved in terms of fixing leaks and various ways of dealing with that. And so as we began to consider the need for a rule change, it sort of became clear that was really the area that we needed to focus on. And so the rules, as Josh pointed out, really have two really significant components in terms of how it impacts municipal Lake Michigan users. One is we want to update the conservation and efficiency standards. I think that's fairly non-controversial because those fixtures are readily available in plumbing stores and hardware stores. You see them adopted throughout the country. They seem to work just fine. So it really seems to make perfect sense to say, let's make sure our standards as a state reflect what's the currently a best standard out there as well. But then, of course, the other one is how we deal with unavoidable leakage. And you've all seen this thing, and if our rules are adopted, that will disappear. Now, the other thing I want to take a minute, the intention of our rules, and Josh hinted at that a little bit, but is if a community is out of compliance with that 8%, once we eliminate unavoidable leakage, the compliance activity is to submit a plan to say, here's what we think we need to do, and here's how much time we think we need to do it. That's the compliance action that, as a state agency, we're looking for. So in other words, we want to be a source of encouragement to communities to assist them in doing whatever they need to begin to pay more attention to water loss. I think it will be in their best long-term economic interest. In fact, I know it is. We've been looking at this for 30 years, and I have yet to have one community call me up and say, it cost us a lot of money to comply with that 8% standard. We're never going to get that back. In fact, it's always been the opposite, because leaks never get smaller, they always get bigger. And so it just seems like we're at this point in time where we really as a state need to send a message to encourage communities to start paying more attention to water loss, especially water systems management. Again, our intention is to say, you know, every community is unique. And regardless of how many staff we have, we're not going to understand how every water system operates, the particular nature of it, the type of materials the water mains relate in, you know, all of the factors that go into running and operating a system. The folks at the local level, they know that. So really, we want them to tell us, based on their knowledge of their system, what do they need to do to fix it. You also know all of the other challenges you face as a municipality, roads, streets, sewers, everything else that goes on, in the financial challenges you have. And so the time frame is really something we want you to focus on rather than to have us dictate to you, because in some cases it will take a long time to restore a system to good, proper operating condition. We know that. It's, you know, in some cases it might be a relatively easy fix, but I suspect for a lot of them it's going to be very, very long term, and we recognize that. And so our job as an agency, at least in the way I look at this, is we will look at that compliance plan, and if it looks and appears that it will address the problem and address it in a responsible way from a time standpoint, our action will be to say, yeah, it looks good. Go ahead and do it. And so, again, you know, we really want to be working with local government. You know, that's, I think, been our operation over the last 33 years. We've held very few enforcement hearings. And, again, our intention has always been to promote efficient use because it makes sense for you guys. And from a state perspective, it allows us a little better leeway in terms of ensuring that we stay in compliance with the decree both today and in the future. So I think with that, I'll stop and turn it over to Mike Ramsey. One last thing, and I don't know if Josh mentioned, we've got three public meetings scheduled that are coming up next week. We have two. The following week, we have another one. I'd be happy to get you information on that. The whole point of that is to allow a more expanded version for folks to come and talk about our proposed changes. We've also invited Illinois EPA to come and talk about their clean water infrastructure program, as well as Tim Loftus from CMAP will be talking about a local technical assistance project that we've been partnering with. So if you haven't RSVP'd, please do so, but even if you can't, come anyway. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
I'd just like to start out by thanking Josh and the Metropolitan Planning Council for inviting me here today to speak in front of you. And you guys are probably like wondering, why is Mike Ramsey from the Village of Westmont here? You know, I mean, probably most of you don't even know where Westmont is. So I'm going to explain to you a little bit about Westmont. But we are located in DuPage County. We are between Hinsdale and Lyle, Naperville, Downers Grove. We have 26,000 people in our town. We started having a water system back in 1909. We started with one community well, went all throughout the whole inner part of our town, right around the train tracks, and we kind of expanded over years. And then the big thing happened was our radium levels got high. So we had to do something, because like a lot of municipalities around here, you know, the EPA raised or lowered their radium level. We either had to build a treatment plant or start taking Lake Michigan water. So back in the late 60s, Westmont started planning on doing that, and by 1991, we started receiving Lake Michigan water. So the first year, we thought, oh, this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to us. But what happened was we ended up with 161 main breaks. We had 8 in a day. We had 40 in a month. We had 22 in a week. It was just crazy. We were working 2 weeks nonstop. I just got married. My wife was like, I didn't buy into this when I married you. You know, I didn't know you were never going to be home, you know. So it was very, very stressful. So we knew we had to do something. We knew we had to, you know, we had to correct our issues, you know, and our water main, you know, started back in 1909. So we knew we had 90-year-old water main or 80-year-old water main in our town. So what we started doing was, first thing was we did a leak detection program. We wanted to find out where all these leaks were and make sure we can fix all these leaks. We wanted to make sure we knew where they were all at and start that program. Then once we found out where all the leaks were, we repaired as many as we could and took care of all the problems we thought we had, but we realized our water main was just too old. We couldn't keep up with that pace. We couldn't afford to keep just repairing water main breaks. So what we ended up doing is we started a water main replacement program. So since 1991 till now, we replaced over 20 miles of water main, and our system's 91 miles long. So we've replaced almost 25% of our system. Now, our system right now, we only have 10% of our system that's 80 years or older now. And every year we try to keep budgeting for and replacing at least a mile of water main every year. So with that, that was one program we started, but we knew that just wasn't enough. We weren't getting the revenue that we needed. We couldn't figure out why. And we started looking at our cash registers, which are our water meters. And we realized we hadn't changed our water meters in 15, 20 years. So back in 1994, we started with a new water meter replacement program, started replacing our water meters, and we realized after testing first 1,000 that we took out, that we were registering around 70 to 80% of our revenue. We were losing 20%, 20 to 30% of our revenue. So we knew this is a good way to get started on collecting revenue and start paying for some of these programs. Besides doing that, besides our leak detection program and our water main replacement program, we started testing our large water meters every year. We've realized that's where our bulk of our revenue is. It's important to make sure that they're 100% accurate. So every year we test our top 100 meters. Every other year we actually rotate because we have about 250 large meters in town. So every other year we're testing those meters, making sure they're 100% accurate. Once that's all done, we realized we doubled our revenue just by replacing our meters, testing them. It was a huge bonus for us. But again, even with all that, we knew that we still had a lot of issues if we're going to keep paying for this over the years. So what I did was back in 2008, 2009, I did a water rate study for our town. And I wanted to make sure that what we were paying, what we were producing the water, we were getting back in revenue. So we started, we went through the whole process, took over a little over a year to do, and we realized we were not getting the revenue that we needed to pay for these programs, and that what we're producing on our system, we just were not getting that revenue back. I'm so glad I did this, but right before City of Chicago and DuPage Water Commission increased their rates, I went to our village board and said, we need to increase our water rates. And, you know, like everybody else, that's not popular. I mean, that's like the last thing a board wants to hear. But I did a big PowerPoint presentation. I explained to them that we were not getting our revenue back. We were losing, you know, what was costing us to produce this water and to deliver this water to our residents, we were not getting back in revenue. So we needed to do something. So we increased our water rates. And luckily for me, it came at the same time that, you know, by the time this whole program went through and they agreed to accept the new water rate, it was the same time City of Chicago and DuPage Water Commission increased theirs. So what did we do? We blamed it on City of Chicago and DuPage Water Commission. So I said, the reason we're increasing our water rates is because City of Chicago and DuPage Water Commission are telling us that, you know, they're going to increase their rates, or we're just going to pass it along to our residents. So the timing was perfect. But what benefits us now is we have a 15-year plan now, aggressive plan, that we're going to, you know, replace our water main, replace water meters every 10 to 15 years as needed. And, you know, we can just blame it on the City of Chicago and DuPage Water Commission. So that was one of our big things. But even that, we knew we had to educate our residents. You know, so what we started back with DuPage Water Commission in 2008, 2009, started a DuPage County-wide water conservation program. So we piggybacked with them, and we started our own water conservation program where we provide rain barrels to our residents at cost. We buy those from the Conservation Foundation in Naperville. We also participate every year in Fix a Leak Week, where we invite all residents in. We educate them, tell them, you know, we have Kohler come in. That was one of our companies that came in and helped us out with this, showing them how to be more efficient, use low-flow toilets, use, you know, low-flow shower heads. So they were great with that, and our residents learned a lot from that. We also, next year, we're starting a toilet rebate program. I know Batavia has one right now that we're going to try to model ours after, but it's just things we're trying to do to get our residents involved and educate them as best we possibly can. And then the final thing we started doing was we started having educational programs at the schools. We invited the schools in, taking tours of our plant, educating them on how we conserve water and how they need to start conserving water. And we have Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts and all these other younger kids coming in, giving a tour, educating them, giving them water bottles. We give them these aluminum water bottles. Please use water bottles, you know, aluminum ones, not plastic water bottles, please. So we educate them that way. But the big question is, what I've been hearing from a lot of municipalities is, how are you going to pay for all this? A lot of municipalities are going to, like, okay, all these programs sound great, but how do you pay for them? And I said, you know, we had to increase our water rates a little bit, but we've also taken advantage of the ARRA. Back in 2009, we replaced 2 miles of water main. Thank you, President Obama, for that. We pay that back at no interest. And we also we're looking into taking the Clean Water Initiative that Governor Quinn has initiated. He has, you know, a couple billion dollars sitting out there that any municipality can apply for. So we're looking into doing that to pay for some of our programs too. There are ways to do this. So it's not, don't feel like it's, you know, it's, this is going to be an overwhelming program, you know, that INDNR is proposing. It's really not. And if you sit down, I've looked at both. I've looked at the AWWA water audit, and I've looked at LMO2, and there's really not a huge amount of differences. I personally think, this is just my personal opinion, I think the water audit from AWWA is a little more accurate. I think it's more realistic. I think the LMO2 can be skewed one way or another. I've looked at both of them, and it didn't really affect our water loss that much. I mean, we were at 2% with LMO2, a little less. When I did the water audit, we were just under 4%. So there's a little bit of a difference, but not a huge amount. So I think municipalities just need to be more conscientious of what you're doing for your community, And, you know, by saving water, it's going to end up paying for itself. It really is. I mean, that's what we've seen over the past 15 years, is that these programs that we've put in place end up paying for themselves over time. So, well, that's all I have. Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Mike Smythe. I'm the Senior Operations Manager for the Chicago Metro District of Illinois American Water. Very excited to be here this afternoon. I would like to thank Josh and everyone at MPC for their leadership on important issues, especially not only from a regional perspective, but specifically on water issues. We greatly value their leadership on water issues, and want to thank them for bringing us here today. Can I do this here? Okay. Just a brief overview of Illinois American Water Company. Across the state, as you can see, we serve approximately 1.2 million people. And we stretch from north, from the north end to the south end. We have four large districts right here in Chicago and Chicago Metro. We also serve Champaign, Urbana, Peoria, and what we call our interurban district, which is essentially the St. Louis side in Illinois, Belleville, Alton, as you can see on the map. Locally in Chicago, we actually provide water service to 44,000 customers, and we're a bit unique to American Water in the fact that we also provide wastewater service for 32,000 customers. And from a population standpoint, we cover about 125,000 people. So in and around the Chicago suburbs, we're probably that makes us about the fourth or fifth largest water service provider behind Aurora, Naperville, Joliet, for example. So we have over 30 service areas in and around the suburbs of Chicago, including Bolingbrook, Homer Glen, and Orland Hills, where we encompass the entire community. Past that, we're parts of several communities, and then we also provide service in many, many small unincorporated subdivisions. And of importance for today's discussion, we are regulated by the Illinois Commerce Commission. Now, on the proposed rule changes, we are generally speaking in favor of the proposed rule changes. We certainly favor full cost pricing. Truth be told, that's something we already do today, so it's not a stretch for us to favor that, but we believe that's extremely important to the water utility industry. We also favor the conservation measures proposed, although we do not have authority to enforce. Now, I have up on the screen favor of the 8% limit change. Essentially, that's the MUL, the elimination of the MUL allowance that we've been talking about. We are in favor of that. However, we did propose that the two-year time frame be extended to 5 to 10 years to give water utilities a time to plan for it and mitigate potential rate impacts to customers. We do feel strongly that we should eliminate the allowance for the age of water main. Now, in preparing for today, this is a great piece of information that we talk about a lot within our company. And this is the American Society of Civil Engineers report card of infrastructure across the country. And this is the summary for the state of Illinois. And I want to point you to the quote in the top center of the page, and for those of you in the back, I'll read it. This is from Abraham Lincoln. "I am a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. The great point is to bring them the real facts." Now, MPC has assembled a great group here today. We're water industry professionals, elected officials, directors of public works, professional engineers. Who better in the land of Lincoln than Abraham Lincoln himself to lead us to an important concept? We believe that full cost pricing is very, very important, and that's why we favor the proposed rule change. You know, water rates that don't reflect full cost pricing are subsidized through property taxes, sales taxes, utility taxes, and so on. And in addition to that, you know, rates that don't reflect full cost pricing sort of lead to a situation where we don't invest in our systems. And I think, you know, Dan showed a chart earlier where the, you know, the MUL allowance has been going up in the last handful of years. And I think that perfectly illustrates the fact that we're not investing in our systems. Collectively, we need to step up. You know, the city of Chicago has taken huge steps in the last couple of years to make necessary infrastructure investment. Yet more people are concerned about increasing water rates rather than declining water levels of Lake Michigan. Fact of the matter is, the city of Chicago needed to make necessary infrastructure investment. And that's beneficial for the entire region. Illinois American Water, as an investor-owned regulated utility, makes similar prudent infrastructure investment when necessary. Let's take a look at this piece of information. In this, across the bottom, you can see estimated needs based on U.S. Environmental Protection Agency estimates. And across the bottom there, it shows a wastewater need of $17.5 billion over the next 20 years. From a drinking water perspective, we need approximately $15 billion of investment over the next 20 years. Major, major investment. Now, if you think about infrastructure investment, there was an AUS utility report issued in 2010. And essentially what it showed is that the water utility industry is more capital intensive than the gas and electric utilities combined. Water infrastructure is, for the most part, underground. It's out of sight, out of mind, and it's very easy to take for granted. But these numbers here really illustrate the need for infrastructure investment. Now, as I mentioned, Illinois American Water is a regulated utility. Now, think about that $15 billion number from a water investment need over the next 20 years. On a per capita basis for the state of Illinois, that equates to about $58 of investment per person per year over the next 20 years, state of Illinois. In the Chicago Metro District, our company has invested $28,540,000 approximately in the last 5 years. For the 125,000 people we serve, that's $45.50 per person. So we're making that investment. We're able to make that investment because our rates cover full cost. They reflect full cost pricing. If our rates didn't reflect full cost pricing, we wouldn't be in the ballpark. Now, obviously, we can all do better, and we know that. But the fact of the matter is, because our rates reflect full cost pricing, we can come close to that number. Now, full cost pricing isn't something that, you know, Illinois American Water has made up, as you've heard from Josh earlier. And I'll just point a couple of quotes up on the screen. You know, CMAP has endorsed full cost pricing. It's recommended to encourage conservation, right? The U.S. EPA, it's from their website. Pricing of water services should accurately reflect the true cost of providing high-quality water. It's very simple. It's an important concept for us to embrace. Now, in closing, I want to take you back to the quote from Abraham Lincoln, and I won't read it again to you, but you can see that we need to bring consumers the real facts. It's very simple. We need to bring full cost pricing, the true cost of water, to the consumer. And I think there's a reason why the IDNR has proposed these rule changes. There are many entities that endorse full cost pricing, as I've mentioned. Now, we can no longer reward water utilities for putting off needed infrastructure investment. Older pipes shouldn't mean greater allowances for loss. Older pipes should mean a requirement for infrastructure investment. We need to collectively step forward, and that is why we favor these changes. As water industry professionals, and I mentioned earlier, there's a great group assembled here today, we can take a leadership role, and I applaud MPC for their leadership on this issue, and I appreciate everyone's time today. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all. We have a bit of time for some Q&A, some discussion. Someone to walk around a microphone. Abby Chrysostomo, who was a great help on the report and the presentation and everything else today. We are recording this event for Chicago Amplified, which is a program of Chicago Public Radio. So it is very important that you wait for Abby to come with the microphone so that we capture you forever in perpetuity in our sound files. So questions for myself, Dan, Michael, or Mike in the back. Wait for Abby. State your name. Who are you? Tell the world.
Hi, my name is Aline Bayard. I teach a sustainability course at the University of Chicago. You might have covered this, Josh, but my question is, what does it take to actually have full-cost pricing implemented? Is that a regulatory issue? Is that a consumer issue? How does that move forward in terms of the bureaucracy?
Two different ways. The full-cost pricing, this one? Full-cost pricing fundamentally is a decision made at the level of the water utility. So IDNR and its permit conditions can recommend or require that its permittees take steps over time to move towards full-cost pricing. IDNR is never going to set water rates for an individual municipality. It's never going to set water rates for an investor-owned utility like Illinois American. That has to happen locally, and it requires internal accounting at that utility of what costs are needed to maintain current operational levels, meet regulatory standards, and meet the level of performance that your customers, whether they be the residents of a municipality or the customers of a private utility, the performance level that they want. At a municipal level, like with the city of Chicago's famous or infamous rate increase, it had to be agreed on by the city council, in another suburban municipality, it would be the village council, that makes a vote to agree on that. It becomes a political decision. For an investor-owned utility, they determine their costs and they determine a rate structure, and then they actually have to make a case to the Illinois Commerce Commission to show that their rates are justified and that the thing they're doing is approved. So a little bit different whether you're a municipality or an investor-owned utility. This can't be possible.
Hi, Kristen Ray, City of Evanston. You know, I think a lot of the stuff that you've been talking about is not news to most of us in the room, but the problem is that we don't control the purse strings. It's the elected officials. So what are MPC and the DNR and CMAP and other entities like that planning to help us reach out to elected officials and to the public to make them understand the need for this, the need for action sooner than later, and make it a little more palatable sure. for them and not make it such a political issue?
Sure. I'll let Dan answer that for the department. And then I might ask Tim Loftus from CMAP to say a few words about your local technical assistance project. He's nodding in the back, and then I'll share MPC's perspective.
Well, I guess I would just say that, you know, I view our role as helping to be a catalyst for better systems management. So if we have a revised standard on water loss, for example, that we've proposed, hopefully that will give you as a water operator leverage to say, here's a new standard that has been placed upon us. We think it's in our best long-term interest as a community to work towards this standard because it will allow us more efficient use and ultimately save our community money. But I think at the end of the day, that argument on spending money still has to be made with a local justification. I guess I've always been somewhat sensitive to that, you know, you need to make the case to say, this is in our best interest, and it also happens to be consistent with the state's program for overseeing the allocation of water from Lake Michigan. To just say you have to do it because the state's saying you have to, I suspect that politically doesn't help you all that much. But hopefully, having it say they coincide and they reinforce each other, hopefully might help get you over that hurdle. But, you know, we recognize that there is a tremendous diversity within our Lake Michigan service area. I mean, in some respects, we probably have a rather select group here today, but there are many, many communities that we know are struggling in every way. You know, they're struggling to make payroll. They're struggling to do a lot of things. And so, you know, again, our role as the state is to try to have a management program that can apply to all of them and be done in an equitable manner.
Tim, a few comments?
Sure. Thanks, Josh. CMAP staff and our partners like the Center for Neighborhood Technology and others are willing, upon invitation, to come out and engage city councils and village boards and help make that case. So we are available to spread that gospel, if you will. But until such time as the state of Illinois and IDNR in particular receive new funding for state and regional water supply planning, our ability is really limited to responding to invitations as opposed to a more proactive and comprehensive approach such as we followed the publication of 2050 with for the next 2 years.
And I was 2 seconds away from putting someone else on the spot, but he just walked out of the room. I was going to ask Mayor Barrett Peterson from Franklin Park to explain how it is that they as a municipality have made substantial investments and what convinced him from the staff to make those tough choices. And so since he left early, I will speak for him and say, and he's probably out by the elevators right now, I will say that what changed his mind was proof that over the long run, the village was going to save money by reducing waste in losses, the electricity costs, the pumping costs, the cost to purchase water from the city of Chicago, that eventually, over time, they will save money by spending money. And I'm sure that's what Mayor Peterson would have said had he been in here to answer the question. We have time for one more question. Danielle?
Yep. All right, so if I cheat, and it's not a question, but I can add to answering Kristen's original question. I'm Danielle Galley. I work for the Center for Neighborhood Technology. We're in partnership with CMAP and IDNR doing a year-long research project about water loss issues for Lake Michigan permittees. The Center for Neighborhood Technology, as far as other resources Kristen was asking about, we will, within the next couple weeks, be releasing a brief titled The Case for Fixing the Leaks, which addresses what we believe is an issue about this situation, being that there is a knowledge gap between what everyone in this room is aware of and what the general public still has yet to understand about the larger context of this issue and making this case for why it's important that they start paying attention to it. So that will be released out pretty soon. It's specifically directed at the general public and elected officials. It's also a great piece of scintillating information that will be coming out, to use Josh's word earlier. And I also want to mention that as chair of the Water Efficiency Committee for the Illinois section of AWWA, a number of the other members in this committee are here today, including Mike. We are working on fact sheets that we're going to be releasing out to any members that will be addressing why is it important that elected officials pay attention to water efficiency? Why is it important that elected officials pay attention to this water loss issue? So this is a resource that, as members of ISAWWA, we're going to be making available. If anyone wants cards from me or anybody else on the committee, we're happy to be sending out those resources as a way to get this issue out in front of the public more often so that they can understand what everyone in this room is facing as well.
I think the basic answer to the question was, give us a call, whether it's MPC or CNT or CMAP or others, and we're happy to come speak to elected officials, be they mayors, village councils, city councils, about the need for investment. We actually have time for one more question, so yes, go ahead. And Commissioner Spiropoulos from MWRD is leaving before I can put her on the spot to answer the question. So. All right.
Hi, my name's Brian Jack. I'm with the Village of Oak Park. To talk about getting our elected officials on board with full cost pricing and water mm-hmm. conservation. We actually partnered with CMAP along the city of Evanston did as well with a water and energy efficiency plan that was actually just adopted by our village board this past April with very little comment from the board, because what we did is we did for a year before we even presented to the board, we did a public outreach program, had countless meetings with residents, explain what we're doing, explain the goals of our plan, that which included doing a rate study, working with our top 5 users in Oak Park to reduce consumption, which also put in there the ramifications of reduced consumption means reduced revenues. So it was a big public outreach that we had a lot of members from the community that came to the board meeting when we were presenting it to our board, and which helped a lot with getting our elected officials on board with this is what we want to do. And also goes along with our sustainability programs in Oak Park. It was just another part of the whole program. So it was a lot of public outreach helped us out a lot.
Perfect. So to wrap up, Mary Sue Barrett, MPC's president, is going to come up and say a few words. But Todd Main, who's the chief of staff at the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and is behind the podium, asked to share a few thoughts with you before Mary Sue says her final thoughts.
Thank you, Josh, and I'll just say a couple things. One, thank you, everybody, for coming. I want you to understand that from the agency's perspective and from the governor's perspective, this is a discussion, and we're in the beginning part of this discussion. We're going to have a number of public meetings and talk more about this moving forward, but we want you to all be active participants in this because it's important public policy. It's important for the state, particularly because we are now in an environment where we get a much higher scrutiny of these kind of issues. And when thirsty southwestern states look to the Great Lakes for their solving their water problems, we have a much stronger case when we can say we are good stewards of the resources that we have here in front of us, and we manage those. And it's a new discussion that we're having in Chicago where we look out and see endless amounts of water just down the street. But at the same time, it's a conversation that we have to have. I think it's important that we think about it in terms of investment, because what we're really talking about is making investments that will generate real dollar returns for the communities across Northeast Illinois. And it's a conversation, and we're very interested in your feedback and hope that you stay engaged as we move forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Todd. I want to add my thanks to all of you for coming. I'm Mary Sue Barrett, president of the Metropolitan Planning Council, and as some of you regulars know, we do this often, about 15 or so times a year. We have roundtables here, and what I truly enjoy is that each one attracts a very distinct audience of people who need to know each other and can join forces by coming together to learn and then departing together with a shared agenda. So we clearly are here to share knowledge, but also to work on action. We would not have been able to do this without the great panel, so thank you, Josh, for kicking us off. I know that we have experts and non-experts in the room, but Dan and Mike and Mike all contributed to making sure that we didn't fall off that cliff of being overwhelmed, but you pulled us back each time and made sure that we understood the importance of the data. We could also not have done this without Illinois American Water as our sponsor. They have been a terrific partner. Carla Olson-Teasley from Illinois American Water is a member of our resource board, and we're very fortunate at MPC to have lots of people from the private sector and from the community sector joining with us as advisors. IDNR, all the work that you've done to lead the way, your proposals point us in the right direction, and thank you for being part of sparking both the conversation through the comment period and now the public hearings that follow and today's event. We do not do any of our work except in partnership with so many organizations throughout our region and our state and our tri-state region, which we think of as the mega metropolitan region. Some of those include CMAP, MWRD, Openlands, Christopher Burke Engineering, Center for Neighbor Technology, Alliance for the Great Lakes, Northwest Water Planning Alliance, the Joyce Foundation, and a list that I could continue and continue. Your range of expertise, your opinions, all of which we kind of sort through and learn from each other together, allows us to zero in on pragmatic, implementable solutions. And finally, I also want to recognize all of you who are in the business of delivering water. We learn so much from you, and we're delighted that we got such great interest in attending from Chicago to Westmont. We've got folks here from Franklin Park to Tinley Park and lots of places in between. You counseled us in the writing of this report, so we hope you'll use it, and you also spent your time submitting comments. For almost 80 years, the Metropolitan Planning Council has been in the business of problem solving. We want to make sure that those solutions are pragmatic and innovative. There's a healthy tension there of trying to achieve both those. We do that through our research, through our advocacy, through our on-the-ground demonstration projects, and through convening, like today. This frank discussion is something that we want to continue, both as attendees and sponsors to help us continue to these events is very useful to us. We have a sheet on your seats for our next roundtable, which is a week from tomorrow, Wednesday the 15th. It's called Tough Stuff, Resilient Infrastructure in a Changing World. It is supported by Commonwealth Edison as our sponsor, and it covers everything from security threats to extreme weather, and asks the question, which we'll attempt to answer, of are we prepared? There'll be some great experts there to share case studies, and we've made it easy because there's actually a part on the bottom of that announcement that you can even leave with us today if you want to take care of registering without going back to your computer and clicking. We also, not in your seats, but on the table is when you leave, have a list of other planned roundtables for 2013. We go about identifying the topics in two ways. It could be like today, where we knew we were going to be doing work on this topic, and we were fortunate to team up with Illinois American Water to sponsor this today. That was something we always thought we would be doing in 2013. The idea for the one next week on resilient infrastructure came from conversations with ComEd. So take a look at the list. If there's something there that sparks your attention, great. If there's something that's not there that you think MPC would be the great convener and relevant to our agenda, we're all ears. We'd love to talk to you about that and to partner with you in sponsoring an additional event. There's a survey on your seats. Please take a moment to fill it out. You can just leave it right there. It really helps us understand what worked about today's event and what you'd like in the future. And the lunches that you enjoyed today, you can just slide under your chair. You don't need to do anything else with them. We'll take care of it. So thank you again for joining us. I hope you can stay for a minute to mix and mingle and meet some more people, as I hope to do myself. Thanks again to our panelists.